Welcome to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne. We're in chambers this week, clearing the docket. And with me is the man known best for his Brooklyn General Store hat, of which my six-year-old son also has one, Judge John Hodgman.
That's right. I can see you, Jesse Thorne. And you are looking well.
I'm wearing a summer cardigan.
Yeah, well, I mean, you please bundle up. It's got to be all the way down to 100 degrees out there in Los Angeles.
There's only one climate zone in my house. And so when we set the thermostat to like 78 or 80, which is usually what we do in the hottest parts of the year, somehow still in my office, it is 32 degrees. So I'm currently wearing shorts and a t-shirt, but over my t-shirt, I'm wearing a cashmere cardigan, and I'm also wearing like wool-lined slippers.
You know, I think that that's the outfit of the pandemic. Like, we don't know what's happening. We don't know what we're preparing for. We don't know what's happening next. But I love a summer cardigan. That's why I call you Summer Cardi T.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. I'm a dad.
Also outside my window right now, thanks to the current disaster situation in California, they appear to be using red filters on the sky like they were shooting Dune.
Yeah. Yeah.
It may just be that they've got a few shots left for that Timothée Chalamet Dune.
I will go on and on and on about that trailer. But for now, I don't want to go on and on because we've got a very special guest. I don't want to waste time messing around. I love you, but Emily Brewster is back.
Oh, long time, wow.
long time, year one friend of the court, Emily Brewster, who listeners will remember, is a lexicographer, dictionarian, works at the dictionary, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. She's an editor there, and she discovered the word A. go back. That's still true, right, Emily?
Oh, yes. Yes, that one's all mine.
Have you discovered any more words since you discovered A?
Oh, gosh, have I discovered any new words? Sure, infodemic is one I was researching recently.
Really? Infodemic? Mm. That sounds hot and relevant. What's that all about?
It's a Sharknado with information instead of sharks.
That's a great description. You know, I should really put that in the actual definition, a Sharknado of misinformation or disinformation. It is the false and or ambiguous even information that spreads like a pandemic.
Well, that's amazing. A extremely talented Emily Brewster is researching the word pandemic. Did I use A in the way that you put it into the dictionary correctly?
You did. I think that sense is what, 2D? And it's supposed to, you know, it means that the condition of the referent has changed in some way from a former hypothetical condition.
We'll put the link to the episode where we talked all about that on our show page. But in the meantime, I just realized, like, I just said, A extremely talented Emily Brewster is researching the term pandemic. What I should say, an extremely talented Emily Brewster is researching the term pandemic. Did I just discover Anne?
Well, I mean, discover is an interesting word. What do you mean by discover?
I don't know. Why don't you look it up?
Yeah, look it up in the frickin' dictionary.
All right, look, I'll explain. We got a lot to cover today, and we're going to have a lot of fun with words. But when I say Emily, because I have great respect for you, even though the Merriam-Webster Dictionary Twitter account is at war with me, once a month posting that a hot dog is a sandwich, that's okay. I'm going to let that go. Let that go. But Emily Brewster and I have roots back in Western Massachusetts. Are you still out there in the Pioneer Valley, Emily?
I am.
How are things out there? Hot?
They're beautiful. Hot, it's a rainy day today, and the rain feels really nice.
Terrific. And Emily Emily works at the dictionary, the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. She is an editor there. And when I say she discovered the word A, what I mean is, Emily, you realize that there is a usage of the word A that was not currently covered in the dictionary, and you got it in there. And it was, as you described, in the usage of, well, why don't you give me an example that would be appropriate?
The example that's actually in the definition is a triumphant Ms. Jones greeted her supporters. So the A there tells you that she's not always triumphant, that she is different from a former, right, usual, or hypothetical condition.
Right. And that's the example of usage in the dictionary. You put that in that dictionary.
That's right.
When I say an extremely talented Emily Brewster, first of all, you are always extremely talented, so it doesn't even make sense. But an extremely talented Emily Brewster is researching infodemic for the dictionary. Is that usage of an in the dictionary currently, or do I get one now?
No, that's in, you know, an is really just a variant of a or a.
I thought I got one. All right. No,
the dictionary is not really about glory, really.
I strongly disagree. You don't know the number of letters we got and get every week with people pedantically seeking glory by correcting my grammar and usage. We're going to dig into it in a moment. But first, I need to say you have a new podcast called Word Matters. Is that correct, Emily?
That is correct.
Tell me about the podcast.
The podcast is for editors chatting about things we uncover in the work of lexicography. So lexicography is really always a very solitary work. We don't generally talk to one another. When I first arrived at Merriam-Webster, we didn't use email that much yet. People were still passing around these slips of paper because you would never want to interrupt somebody while they were working. So it's very solitary work. But this podcast is for editors talking about things we've discovered in the course of our work.
So like grammar rules, surprising word origins, the hidden weirdness of the English language?
Yes, yes. New words like infodemic or the use of matriculate. That means to proceed forth like the football player matriculated down the field. That is
whoa.
That's
a thing that happens in
you've
sports.
Never, John, you've never heard Al Michaels say that while calling Monday Night Football.
No, I've got to start watching
Herschel
the sports.
Walker matriculating down the field.
Matriculating down the field. All right. So where and when can we listen to it? Is it when or whem can we listen to it?
whem?
I don't want to get in trouble. Or maybe I'm using whem?
It's available on all the platforms that people use to get their podcasts, or also at NEPM.org. That's New England Public Media, which is our local public radio and TV station. They just merged and became New England Public Media.
Yeah, I fire up my smart speaker regularly to listen to New England Public Media, just to have a taste of the old public radio station that I used to listen to out there in Western Mass.
Oh,
that's great. Yeah, I say, Alexa, play Huey Lewis and the News on New England Public Media. That's your running bit, Jesse, and I just stole it.
Alexa is the program director of New England Public Media.
That's right. So before we begin to clear the docket, I just want to say here, I've been spending a lot of time at the Merriam-Webster website, and hot dog is defined as a frankfurter with a typically mild flavor that is heated and usually served in a long split roll. Says nothing about a sandwich. Terrific. Let's move on. Jesse Thorne, let's clear the docket.
Well, we're talking word origins. Here's something from Karen. She says, my husband insists on pronouncing the word origin with the accent on the second syllable. Origin. That is indeed how it's pronounced when it has an ending, such as original, originally, and originated. Can his pronunciation be defended, or may I continue to correct him when he says it?
So, Emily, as a lexicographer, how much do you personally involve yourself in pronunciation issues, or is that a separate team at the dictionary?
That is separate. We have a pronunciation editor, and he is in charge of all the pronunciations.
And what do you think this person would say about origin?
Well, it's not an established pronunciation. That is very clear.
Mm-hmm. I was about to come down hard on this person, because I've always said origin, as in Stan Lee's Secret Origins of Marvel Comics. That's where every white man my age learned that term. That's how you learn how all the people got their superpowers originally. So, Emily, do you agree that origin is the way to say it? I know this is not your job.
It's not my job, but it's very clear that origin is the only established pronunciation, and that this shift in related words, you know, the which syllable is stressed in a particular word for groups of words, this is really common that they change.
Yeah. How does the pronunciation editor, did I say editor? Now I have to say it wrong. How does the pronunciation editor track and update pronunciation? What do they do? Go around and just listen to people talk?
Yeah, basically. I think he mostly stays in one place and listens to people talk.
Does he ever use one of those ear horns? Like, like sort of like you would imagine like an elderly Cyrano de Bergerac would use or whatever? You know, like a handle?
He actually has a door on his office. Most of us just have cubicles, but because he has to listen to audio, and I'm talking like back in the old days when we were right. in the office together, he has a real office with a door that closes. So I have no idea. Maybe he's got ear horns. Maybe he has people coming in and out of there just very surreptitiously. I really don't know.
Wow. What is he listening to in there?
Probably this podcast.
Yeah, I suppose so. So if I say origin, 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 origin enough times, if I spam the machine, it could get into the dictionary?
No, I mean, it's got to spread. It's got to be widespread. It can't just be one very influential person using it. You know,
I think you overestimate me.
But, you know, this feature of the language going from origin to original and originated. Like, if this man wants to always say origin, he's really setting himself up for some real difficulties. Like, he's going to have to say, we've got simple, simplify. He's going to have to say simplicity.
If only to be consistent.
Well, yeah. I mean, and why just stop at origin?
Yeah.
And you get to creativity?
I don't think in the experience of this podcast, it's really a priority among the men who listen to be consistent in their schemes. They mostly want attention. Let me give you an example. Similar to this is a pronunciation issue. Nick wrote in saying, I know and I am fine. Thank you, very generous of you. I know and I am fine with the way people pronounce the word flaccid. But I would appreciate it if the court would recognize it's supposed to be pronounced flaccid, as in accident or accelerate. Emily, I threw my computer into the garbage when I got this email. I was so mad. I had to go down to the recycling room and get it back. Because you know what? I looked it up in the dictionary.
Yeah.
Flaccid is an accepted pronunciation.
It's true.
Had you known that?
Well, yeah.
Oh, I guess because you work there.
John, you've seen her eyeglasses. You know by her signature eyewear that she knows that there's multiple pronunciations that are acceptable for the word flaccid.
Well, and the fact that flaccid is the normal, and it is the dominant pronunciation, flaccid. Right. That is the dominant right. pronunciation. But it really is kind of problematic because one of the few rules that English pronunciation has that is really consistent or almost entirely consistent is that the letter C says S when it has an I, E, or a Y after it. This is almost a sacred rule. It is just so consistent, not 100%. But the fact that this one word bucks that trend, I agree. It's kind of problematic.
So you don't think this word should be allowed to get out there and do its thing?
Oh, well, I mean, of course it should, and it is, and it does, and that's that. But I think the writer has got a point.
Oh, I hate it when the writer has a point. Nick, you have a point. Nick said, I know language evolves and grows and that pronunciations are like dictionary definitions, descriptive, not proscriptive. But I say it the way it's spelled with a hard and soft C, and I don't correct folks who say it with two soft Cs, and I would appreciate the same. I have to afford him that grace, or grace, as I say it.
I think it's a pretty noble approach. Also, I did notice that the OED only gives the flaccid pronunciation, but that entry has not been touched since 1896.
So flaccid is the origin. That's the original.
It is. Version. It is. It wasn't flaccid. The now dominant pronunciation was not in a Merriam-Webster dictionary until like 1961.
That was an incredible year. Yeah. All right, Nick, you won that round. What else
that
do we
got,
Jess? That was
what Bob Dylan wrote the song "The Times They Are a Changin'" about.
That's right. He was. Oh no, I was thinking of "Subterranean Homesick Blues." Why do I know even two Bob Dylan songs?
You're a middle-aged white man, John.
I know, but it's not. I don't have that. I don't have that DNA receptor. All right.
But it's like the AARP invitations. They just start appearing in your mail. Bob Dylan songs start appearing in your mail when you turn 40.
Let's move on.
Would you even know? I can't move on right now. Would you even know what someone was talking about if they said flaccid to you? Because I don't think I would. Even, like, no. It would have to be very specific context for me to even know what word they were saying.
First of all, to the young people who are listening, go get the dictionary and look up the word. I'm not going to tell you what it means.
Yeah, and don't just Google it.
But it's as gross as it sounds in either pronunciation.
Yeah.
Flaccid and flaccid. If someone said flaccid, I would think they were trying to say flaxseed.
Yeah.
But I guess if you're out there saying schedule instead of schedule, and you're spelling jail, G-A-O-L, if you're an OED person, flaccid is the way to go.
Here's something from Heather. She says, I want to file suit against anyone who uses the word curate to mean organized, thoughtfully considered, well thought out, etc. As someone who works in a museum and does real curation, the misuse of the word is degrading against my profession and belittles the stuff I actually do. Curation is more than being thoughtful. It's the physical care of artifacts, art, literature, archives, and other items. A playlist is not curated.
Emily Brewster, what do you think? What does the dictionary have to say? What do you have to say?
The broad use of curate that she's objecting to is only about 20 years old.
Right.
So part of the problem with it is that it's new, and new uses are bothersome. And I understand someone who has this, who has the narrower, older use as part of their identity, that it then being used in this kind of broad way that seems so imprecise. Yeah. I mean, I feel for her, but there's also a long history of this kind of thing happening in English. You know, cultivate started out as being about farming. And in the late 16th century, you could reliably say that that's what it meant, but it was being used figuratively by the late 17th century. And, you know, fiddle originally meant to, like, play a fiddle, 14th right. century. And then, you know, give it a couple hundred years and all of a sudden fiddling is like, you know, it's derogatory and it's for like doing something that isn't very meaningful.
Yeah. Like playing the violin. I'm a violist. So yeah. I accept that derogatory terminology.
My 9-year-old is playing the violin now. And, but he prefers to just fiddle around on it.
Yeah, that's what you do with a violin. Yeah. It's a weaselly, whiny instrument with no gravity. Tell your 9-year-old, get a viola. Everyone loves a violist.
Everybody loves a violist. It's that legendary truism.
Look, also, small pond. When I was playing in the youth orchestra at the extension school of the Boston, of the New England Conservatory of Music, there were like hundreds of fiddlists. How many violists were there? 5. Guess who, how good a musician was I? Medium. Was I first chair viola? Yeah. That meant I sat on the outside. I got to see them from the stage. That's where I got my chops as a performer. Viola is the way to go. So yeah, language moves from the specific to the figurative all the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think even the finest museum curator could put this genie back into this antique bottle while wearing conservation gloves.
Yeah, it seems like it feels like the ship has sailed. But I understand why someone would object.
I'm mad that you just said this ship has sailed on behalf of actual sailors. I feel for Heather as well. That must be hard because I don't think... I mean, being a museum curator is valuable work that has real meaning that people devote their lives to and do not always get a ton of attention or cash for. And I appreciate your curation, Heather. But I'm just going to say my adult daughter curates the heck out of a Spotify playlist. It's incredible. And guess what? She also wears those white conservation gloves while doing it to protect them.
Protect the Spotify playlist from oils.
Emily, Jesse, I just received a breaking pronunciation question over the email this morning that I forgot to add, and it's from a celebrity guest, but I'm not going to talk about it until we come back from the break. That's called a tease.
Okay, let's take a quick break. More items on the docket coming up in just a minute on the Judge John Hodgman podcast. You're listening to Judge John Hodgman. I'm Bailiff Jesse Thorne. Of course, the Judge John Hodgman podcast, always brought to you by you, the members of MaximumFun.org. Thanks to everybody who's gone to MaximumFun.org/join. And you can join them by going to MaximumFun.org/join. The Judge John Hodgman podcast is also brought to you this week by the folks over there at Babbel.
Did you know that learning, the experience of learning, causes a sound to happen?
Let's hear the sound.
Yep, that's the sound of you learning a new language with Babbel.
We're talking about quick 10-minute lessons crafted by over 200 language experts that can help you start speaking a new language in as little as 1, 2, 3 weeks. Let's hear that sound.
Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, rooted in real-life situations, and delivered with conversation-based teaching. So you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world, and you get to hear this sound.
It's not just like a game that pretends to teach you a language. It's also not a rigid, weird, hyper-academic chore. It is an actually productive app that actually teaches you while you are actually having a nice time.
And you get to hear this sound. Here's a special limited time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/Hodgman.
Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/Hodgman, spelled BABBEL.com/Hodgman. Rules and restrictions apply. The Judge John Hodgman podcast is also brought to you this week by our pals over at Made In.
Jesse, you've heard of Tom Colicchio, the famous chef, right?
Yeah, from the restaurant Kraft.
And did you know that most of the dishes at that very same restaurant are made with made-in pots and pans?
Really? What's an example?
The braised short ribs, they're made-in, made-in. The Rohan duck, made-in, made-in. Riders of Rohan, duck!
What about the Heritage Pork Chop?
You got it. Made-in, made-in. Made In has been supplying top chefs and restaurants with high-end cookware for years.
They make the stuff that chefs need. Their carbon steel cookware is the best of cast iron, the best of stainless clad. It gets super hot. It's rugged enough for grills or an open flame, one of the most useful pans you can own. And like we said, good enough for real professional chefs, the best professional chefs.
Oh, so I have to go all the way down to the restaurant district and... Restaurant Town?
Just buy it online. This is professional grade cookware that is available online directly to you, the consumer, at a very reasonable price.
Yeah. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, remember what so many great dishes on menus all around the world have in common. They're made in, made in. Save up to 25% this Memorial Day from the 18th until the 27th. Visit madeincookware.com. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com.
Welcome back to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. We're clearing the docket with lexicographer Emily Brewster. She's the host of Merriam-Webster's new podcast, Word Matters. Hodgman, before we took a break, you mentioned that you had received a pronunciation question
yes.
from a celebrity guest Can you clarify for our audience? Expand, expound?
I don't know if this is going to be as meaningful to you as it is to me and my dear friend from high school, Sam Potts, who walked me through the bookstore and pointed out the jacket designs done by this famous book jacket designer way back. It must have been 1989. When did Jurassic Park the book come out? I'll tell you, I don't know. But it was around that time that I learned the name of Chip Kidd. Emily, do you know who Chip Kidd is?
I do not.
John, I know who Chip Kidd is. He was a guest on my radio show once.
Yeah, of course he was. Incredible and incredibly influential and virtuosic book designer. He designed the famous book cover for Jurassic Park that you still see in all the Jurassic worlds. He's a Batman aficionado and collector, a person of exquisite taste, and somebody I've been lucky to meet a few times in my life. If you look up book jacket designer in the dictionary, Emily, and you don't have a picture of Chip Kidd there, you guys have done it wrong. No offense. He's
okay.
This guy's a real, all right. So, but here's the thing. This is what he writes in. He just wrote in this morning. So excited. So Chip writes, I always contended that the term, and I won't pronounce it, I'll spell it because this is the point. The term N-E-E, that is N-E with an accent and then E, as in a woman's birth name before getting married, if they change their name, that this word has two syllables and is pronounced N-E-E, as in my mom would have been Eileen Hodgman N-E-E Callahan. But Chip says, my late husband, the writer J.D. McClatchy, begged to differ. Can you settle this? I'm going to look up it up in the dictionary. Have you ever heard of a pronunciation of that word as N-E-E, Emily?
I have not.
Yeah. Yeah. And it does not seem to be here in the dictionary. But Emily, Chip Kidd is one of my heroes, and I don't want to tell him that he's wrong. Will you please do it for me?
N-E-E is not an established pronunciation of N-E-E.
N-E-E. It's a great Scrabble word.
Yeah.
Especially since N-E with an accent aigu above the E. I think it's an accent aigu. That's the masculine version. And then if someone drops that N-E on the Scrabble board, you just bang in another E there, build right off of it. But Chip, I gotta tell you, just because there are those two E's, you're my hero. And I know that nay, N-E-E, has two E's. But that's just how it goes. I don't say Chip Kidd because you've got two D's in kid. It's Chip Kidd. Icon.
Here's a letter from Steven. He says, my coworkers and I are having a dispute over the meaning of the phrase next Wednesday, or for that matter, any day of the week. My coworker says it always means the literal next Wednesday. I assert that the meaning changes depending on when in the week it is said. For example, if I say next Wednesday on a Thursday, it wouldn't be tomorrow. Rather, it would mean 8 days from now. Please help us define this.
So, Emily Brewster, we actually have ruled, I feel like in the long history of Judge John Hodgman, I've ruled on this before. Does the dictionary take a position on this, or do you have a common sense position on it that is not covered in the dictionary?
The dictionary allows for the fact that there is ambiguity in the use of this, but...
Well, then what is the dictionary even for?
Yeah. Maybe if the dictionary is all about ambiguity, Emily, maybe all the definitions should just say, you know, whatever.
Sorry, Emily. We apologize. I apologize.
Yeah. We're jealous of your signature eyewear.
What is the ambiguity that the dictionary attempts to describe here?
Well, it's like with biannual... Right, where it can mean, or biweekly is the more common word. It can mean twice a week, or it can mean every other week. And when both usages are fully established, the dictionary has to report that they are both established. And with the word next, it's you know, it sometimes means the one immediately following, but sometimes it means, you know, something a little bit further out. I think that the most common usage is for it to be when the day is the very next day. That would be this Tuesday.
Right. Or tomorrow.
Right. Or tomorrow. And that when we say next Tuesday, we most often people mean in 8 days.
Yeah, that is the ruling of this court as well. Phew.
This directly affected my life the other day, John.
Oh?
Yeah, I inherited my late aunt's record collection, and it's been sitting at my cousin's house in Washington, mm-hmm. D.C. I had planned to go out and collect it at her memorial service, but her memorial service was canceled because of the pandemic. So it's just been sitting in my cousin's apartment, and she's about to move. So I asked my other cousin's husband to get one of his landscaping dudes, he has a landscaping crew, and go and pack them up for me and ship them to here to California. And he agreed to do it next Saturday. He said, we're going to come over next Saturday.
Uh-oh.
And when the following Saturday arrived...
And you opened up the dictionary and you're like, I don't know what he means.
my cousin texted me from her apartment. I thought your cousin and your cousin's friend were going to be here, and they're not. What's up? Do you know? And we figured out that when he said next Saturday, he meant 10 days from then.
Mm-hmm.
And we had both my cousin and I had presumed that he meant 3 days from then, or I guess 4 days from then, whatever.
You mean this Saturday?
Yeah, this coming Saturday, the next Saturday, because it was in that middle region. It wasn't tomorrow.
Right.
It was 3 or 4 days out. And it turned out he meant later.
I appreciate why there is this ambiguity. Because the proximity of day does tend to affect how people think about time. I the opinion of this court is that if you refer to this day, you are talking, and I understand why it's confusing, because you were talking about the next incidents of that day. So if it is a Monday and you say this Wednesday, you mean the next time Wednesday comes around. But if you say next Wednesday, you are talking about Wednesday of the following week, in my opinion. And this shall forever be. No ambiguity. Settled law in the dictionary of the court of Judge John Hodgman. Two entries. And, the word I discovered, and this and next. I guess that's three entries.
No, I will actually go on the record and say that I think this is a great idea, and I hope that your ruling really takes hold and that we then have to revise the dictionary to accommodate this ruling, because I think it makes a lot of sense.
How do we get it into the dictionary?
You got to know somebody, John. Here's a letter from Casey. They write, I teach high school English, and I've noticed that people have started to use the word utilize to replace the word use. This is a major pet peeve of mine. I'm glad, John, that on our show, we're finally getting down to what really matters, the pet peeves of high school English teachers.
That is what matters. How dare you?
First of all, writes Casey, they are not synonyms. Utilize is a specific word that should only be used when describing chemical processes. Second, the pretentious use of the word utilize has taken hold in education by dumb people who want to sound smart.
Harsh.
Please, Judge Hodgman, rule that people need to stop using utilize as a synonym of the word use.
Emily, does this come up a lot in lexicography?
Yes, people don't like utilize, and they don't generally like words that end in I-Z-E.
Whoa, that's nothing ambiguous about that at all. I wasn't expecting such a firm ruling. Who are the people, the lexicographers, or just in general people get upset about this?
In general, people get upset about it. Think about the word incentivize, for example, or the word finalize. It doesn't really bother so much anymore, but for the entire second half of the 20th century, people were very upset about finalize.
Mm-hmm,
even Noah Webster in 1828, he put demoralize in his 1828 dictionary, and people hated it.
What do people hate about eyes?
I don't know. It dates to, what, the 17th century, I think,
yeah.
And it's very effective for turning a noun or an adjective into a verb, and it's efficient. It was created, it was coined by, was it Thomas Nash? I think, I'm not positive. Specifically because he didn't want there to be so many monosyllabic words. So.
Oh, interesting.
So maybe that's part of why people hate it. But as far as it does, I guess, sound kind of pretentious. It sounds like a word that has been unnecessarily lengthened, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's interesting because Casey says that utilizes a specific word that should only be used, point taken, when describing chemical processes. But that is not the definition of utilize in Merriam-Webster. I didn't see a chemical process definition in the dictionary.
No, the word is in no way linked so specifically only to chemical processes.
So what is the difference between, according to the dictionary, between use and utilize? How would you distinguish the usage?
Utilize is defined as to make use of, to turn to practical use or account. Mm-hmm. Kind of like a step away in utilize, right?
Yeah.
It's like there's like a distance in it, and use, like, I'm going to use this fork, mm-hmm. but I'm going to utilize this fork. That, you know, you might be, if you're utilizing the fork, it's probably because you're going to do something that is not the typical thing to do with a fork.
Right. It does sound pretentious. And I think what's interesting to me, and I don't know where Casey picked up this idea that it had a specific scientific connotation.
High school English teachers have an annual meeting where they gather to share pedantries.
Well, I do think that it might have something to do with the classic rivalry between high school English teachers and high school chemistry teachers.
But in this case, she's actually sanctioning the use by the high school chemistry teacher. So that's interesting.
Right. But don't you get the sense that Casey is not demonizing, although there's another eyes, not demoralizing, discrediting the term as being part of the sciences, and that people are using it outside of the specific scientific context, which we now know it doesn't have, are what Casey calls dumb people trying to sound smart by trying to science up their language and make it seem more technical and edumacated. Do you know what I mean? Like, I think I wonder if that's where Casey picked up this idea. In any case, I agree with Casey in the sense that using the simplest and clearest version of the word is probably the best. Here on the Judge John Hodgman podcast, when people are having difficulty expressing themselves, we often encourage them to speak as bluntly and as plainly as the Incredible Hulk. In fact, why did I even say incredible? The Hulk, you know who I'm talking about. Hulk smash, Hulk talk, Hulk use. Hulk no utilize, puny human utilize, Hulk use. I think that's clearer. I'm with you there, Casey. You know, Casey also identified themselves as a grammar Nazi. Is this an issue of grammar or usage, Emily, or utilizationage?
Yeah, this falls into the category of usage for sure, as opposed mm-hmm. to grammar. And people use the words interchangeably, but there actually is a distinction between them that certainly linguists hold and lexicographers hold.
And that distinction would be what?
I like to think of it like this. Grammar is the stuff that a native speaker learns by virtue of being a native speaker. Usage mm-hmm. is more like the manners of the language. So the way you conjugate verbs, that's grammar.
Right.
Right. And the, you know, you putting your pronouns in the right place, that's stuff that no native speaker ever has to think about. But what the meaning of ironic is, for example, is a usage issue. That's something that everybody has to learn. But yeah.
Eventually, all native speakers learn that it's like rain on your wedding day.
Right. Settle for once and for all, ironic.
Oh, man. You know, the ironic thing about that is it's kind of unsettleable.
You really problematized that as I learned my first year of literary theory. You really tropified and problematized that ironic usage. Yeah, usage is how it's used, right? And grammar is how it's proscribed. And the two don't often work together. And I'll say this, Casey. Thank you for being an English teacher. Use is clearer than utilize. Your definition of utilization is wrong. Sorry. And you're not, in this case, a grammar Nazi, you are a usage pedant. And because I think, especially in the year 2020, I just as Heather the curator felt bad having her specific job generalized, Nazis are a real thing. let's just call Nazis Nazis, and let's just call grammar and usage pedants pedants, and let's get Nazis out of here. Whew. Let's move on.
Here's something from Ben. I petitioned the court for a writ of shut your pie hole against my boss, who will not stop using the phrase hone in on. Hone means sharpen. You can't hone in on an issue any more than you can sharpen in on an issue. I ask she be required to avoid the phrase, or to use correct phrasing, which is home in on, just as you can say house in on something.
Emily, Ben's got to be right on this one, right?
Yeah, I'm afraid so. I mean, hone in is so commonly used that we do cover it in the dictionary, but we recognize that home in is older, more established, and that people really hate hone in. So you're wise to go with home in, like a homing pigeon. They're both pretty new, though. Both phrases are hone in is about 10 years newer, but it only dates to, 1965?
Wow.
So home in, they're both like mid-20th century phrases.
So, and you, like, this is what happens, right? People like hone in comes from home in just because someone said it the wrong way one time and it sounded okay. And they didn't realize where it came from. Irregardless is driving everyone up a tree. That just got in the dictionary, right?
No, it's been in the dictionary for a long time, but there was just a big to-do about it.
I thought it just got in.
No. It's been in a very long time.
So I brought it up because Molly just wrote in from Somerville, Massachusetts, also part of the Commonwealth, Emily, where you and I once shared residence. Now we didn't live in a home together.
You shared a hone.
We shared a hone. We shared a tidy hone together. We're both residents of the Commonwealth. At one point I was. My partner Jack corrects others when someone uses a word in a way that isn't correct according to the dictionary, such as literally, irregardless, itching versus scratching, less versus fewer, by accident versus on accident. The dictionary's got to stay on top of all these different uses, correct?
Yes.
And when does the dictionary reach a consensus that a usage like by accident versus on accident deserves to be in the dictionary? Do you have like a meeting every year saying, are we going to finally let people say that they are literally on top of the world?
No. And again, I go back to the lexicography being very solitary, quiet work. There are no meetings. Nobody talks to anybody. Like, that's actually true. But it's all, we write it all down. So you make a case for it. I, as a definer, will, write out the evidence that I have reviewed that has led me to draft a particular definition or revision. And then another editor above me will review that and say yes or no. And then that's that.
Let's take a quick break. We'll be back in just a second. Judge Hodgman, we're taking a break from clearing the docket. What have we got upcoming?
Jesse, last week I reminded our listeners to please register to vote and then vote in November. And before then, join me if you can in taking some time, if possible, every day to get involved and to volunteer with the election. And if you're joining me, it'll be in support of Democrats. Volunteering, phone banking, talking to family, donating time and resources, canvassing. I think the Democratic Party is the best tool for winning the White House this year, the Senate, the House, safeguarding the Supreme Court, the post office, the rule of law, and holding the GOP generally to account for literally making its election platform whatever Donald Trump wants this year, which is not just dangerous in my opinion, but also in my opinion, un-American and gross. Some of you disagree with my support of the Democratic Party. I get it. There are Democrats we love. There are Democrats we don't love. Greg wrote me saying he disagreed with me. I appreciated that. I owe him a letter back. I will write back. While we don't agree on every point, I'm glad to hear Greg's words and your words. If you want to write me at Hodgman@MaximumFun.org, let's engage. And thank you for hearing my words. But Jesse, two folks wrote in with inspiring nice letters that include some direct action you can take if you want to. And I just want to shout out to them. Meg is a listener in Chicago who helps run a chapter of Swing Left, which is a national organization that's been working on swing races in targeted states and districts since 2017. They have a new initiative called The Last Weekends, which includes a coalition of other groups, including Indivisible and Color of Change. And this initiative is to remind people that this year voting isn't enough, and they're trying to recruit people to commit to volunteering, especially during the last three weekends before the election. And I checked out The Last Weekend's website. It looks fantastic. There are all sorts of opportunities to phone bank, to write personal letters to voters in states. They help you every step of the way to host events if you want to host events. I am full up for my phone banking this weekend, but I did commit to volunteer to write personal letters to persuadable voters in North Carolina in honor of John Kimball and David Reese of Election Profit Makers. If you want to check out The Last Weekend's initiative from Swing Left and Indivisible and Color of Change, I made a bit.ly in honor of Meg. It's bit.ly/gogetemmeg. That's GOGETEMMEG, all small letters. We'll put that up on the show page. And finally, Zach wrote in. Zach is not only an activist in Somerville, Massachusetts, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, he is also a former, like me, DJ at WMFO 91.5 on the FM dial, live atop beautiful Curtis Hall on the campus of Tufts University, and a former Judge John Hodgman defendant. And he is personally running a recurring phone bank, getting people to call voters in Pennsylvania. That's being run out of the victory2020.org organization. And he recommended that I give it a try. And so I am going to do it next Sunday. I'm going to join that phone bank next Sunday. And if you want to join me there, I mean, we won't get to talk to each other, but you'll get to talk to voters to remind them to register and vote. And in honor of Zach, you can check that out at bit.ly/gogetemzach. That's GOGETEMZACH. Go get him, Zach. Zach also turned me on to another regular phone bank where the people of Somerville are calling their neighbors in the former Massachusetts territory known as Maine. And I've signed up to do it this Tuesday. And if you want to join me there, you can go to bit.ly. Go get him, Zach's pal. GOGETEMZACHSPAL. Of course, Jesse Thorne, you are completely politically neutral, so this is only an expression of my opinions and beliefs. Thank you for indulging me, but what have you got going on?
Well, we just launched the fall collection in the Put This On shop. That includes not just, of course, handmade pocket squares from vintage textiles, probably our signature product, but also all kinds of amazing vintage Americana and Internationaliana. Among them, a collection of vintage miniature hats. So in the olden days, when you bought a hat, it would be made for you to your specifications. And so if you wanted to buy a hat as a gift, you would get they would give you a miniature hat to put under the Christmas tree or whatever while the hat was being made. I recently obtained an entire collection of these miniature hats. There are like a dozen of them of different styles, and they also have miniature hat boxes that they come with. You know, real legendary hat brands like Stetson and Dobbs and so forth. We also have a collection of mid-century clothing brushes that come in figural holders, so little dogs and little bears and little golfers and monkeys and all kinds of shapes. This was also another collection that I obtained to keep your clothes clean and ready to wear. And of course, the classic 1884 book, Surnames as a Science.
Yes.
Among many other things. Oh, and guess what? A big collection of production scripts from The Simpsons season 6 and 7. So those are all in our shop at putthisonshop.com now. And if you use the code JUSTICE, you get free shipping on almost everything in the good old US of A.
Yeah.
So go to putthisonshop.com and use that code JUSTICE and get yourself or a friend or a loved one some treasures. We'll be back in just a second on Judge John Hodgman.
Hello, teachers and faculty. This is Janet Varney. I'm here to remind you that listening to my podcast, The JV Club with Janet Varney, is part of the curriculum for the school year. Learning about the teenage years of such guests as Allison Brie, Vicki Peterson, John Hodgman, and so many more is a valuable and enriching experience. One you have no choice but to embrace, because yes, listening is mandatory. The JV Club with Janet Varney is available every Thursday on Maximum Fun or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. And remember, no running in the halls.
If you need a laugh and you're on the go, try STOPPODCASTI.
Were you trying to put the name of the podcast there?
Yeah, I'm trying to spell it, but it's tricky.
Let me give it a try.
Okay.
If you need a laugh and you're on the go, call STOPPAD. It'll never fit.
No, it will. Let me try. If you need a laugh and you're on the go, try STOPPDCOO. Ah, we are so close.
Stop podcasting yourself.
A podcast from MaximumFun.org.
If you need a laugh and you're on the go.
Welcome back to the Judge John Hodgman podcast. We're clearing the docket this week of language disputes. And several folks wrote in about phonetic spelling errors, which have become commonly used. Jed doesn't like the use of nother, as in that's a whole nother can of worms.
Right. So that one is, that's like hone in. That's just a mispronunciation that has now become part of everyday language for a lot of people, right, Emily?
It's actually technically a new coinage through a process called meta-analysis, which is when a phrase is broken in such a way that a new word is understood or a new pronunciation of a word is granted. This is the process by which we ended up with the word nickname, which originally was an eek name.
An eek name?
A what?
An eek name. E-K-E. N-A-M.
Eek? What is eek? Like to eek out a fortune? No.
No. I mean, this is Middle English. We're talking like it's super old, right? An eek name was, I don't know, unfamiliar, like a familiar name, or I don't even remember what eek means.
An eek name.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, something happened with orange, right? If you think of what the word is in other familiar languages, right? What is it in Spanish?
Naranja.
Yes, exactly. So it comes from this Arabic word, N-A, with a macron over it, R-A-N-J. And people, English speakers, understood it as, instead of a naringe or nerange, understood it as an orange, right? Like a misdivision. So this is what happened with nother. I think the unfortunate thing for nother is that it is... It really sticks out because other has also stuck around, because other isn't always preceded by an, your coinage, John, right? Your discovery.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Trademark pending.
Good luck with it. Let me know how it goes. We pay attention to trademarks. We really do. Mm-hmm. But nother, this is shocking to me. Nother dates back to the 14th century.
What?
I know. These things can be totally shocking.
Jed, you're wrong. You're so wrong. What about should of instead of should have?
We enter this use of. It's an auxiliary verb. And we label it as non-standard because it is not typically found in published edited text.
There's also one more here, which is Gabriel has a beef, which is that one can say, I have a plethora of podcasts to listen to, or I have plethora podcasts to listen to, and they're both correct.
What?
Emily, what do you think about this? Also, similarly, myriad.
I am not familiar with plethora used as an adjective in the way that he describes.
Because myriad is like, even I can get pedantic about myriad sometime. Because people will say, I have a myriad of options. But isn't it technically correct to say, I have myriad options?
They're both correct. The noun dates to about middle of the 16th century, and the adjective dates to the beginning of the 18th century. So the noun is actually older.
You're just robbing me of my pedantry.
I'm so sorry.
But plethora is a noun, and looking here in the dictionary, I do not see an adjectival form of plethora. I have plethora I have plethora podcasts. I don't know. Gabriel is really messing with my mind. Let's say a plethora of podcasts and myriad of or myriad podcasts. Let the ambiguity continue. All right, let's move on.
Here's something finally from Charlotte. This is a quick dispute. I lived in San Francisco for 7 years. My friends from California often called the ground the floor. For example, if we're outside and one of them drops something on the sidewalk, they'll say, it fell on the floor. If we're in a park, they'll call something on the grass on the floor. I've looked up the definition of floor, and while an ocean floor and a cave floor maybe negate my floor equals indoors and ground equals outdoors understanding, we're very rarely at the bottom of the ocean or in a cave, so I don't think those apply. Am I wrong to think this is weird? I don't want them to change how they speak. I just want to be able to stare at them knowingly each time they say it until they realize what they've said. My friend from the East Coast agrees. Thank you.
I just want to silently disapprove of them until they are ashamed. This person really is from San Francisco. Emily, you're from the Commonwealth of Massachusetts in New England, which is a region of the northeastern United States. Jesse claims to be from San Francisco, which is a Brigadoon-like magic place that supposedly exists on the West Coast. I've never heard of it myself. How does the dictionary deal, before we talk about what a floor is, how does the dictionary deal with regionalism?
Well, we ignore it to some degree until it becomes widely enough known that it kind of expands to enough readership. But it, we don't, I mean, we're not, a, we're, there is an amazing publication called the Dictionary of American Regional English. And if you really want to know about regionalisms, that's where you go.
Can you say that if something's in the grass, it's on the floor, Emily?
That sounds crazy to me.
I agree. I don't think that that's a supportable definition. If that's a regionalism in California, Jesse, you say you're from San Francisco. If you drop your burrito in the Presidio, you remember that old Tony Bennett song, I dropped my burrito in the Presidio?
Sure.
And you're outside. Is it on the floor of the Presidio?
I'm marinating the nub.
No.
This is not familiar to me. I think Charlotte just has a couple of weird friends and has extrapolated falsely. The only real regional usage issue that exists in San Francisco is that in San Francisco, the word cutty is an adjective meaning like dicey or shady. Mm-hmm. And E40 told me that in Vallejo, it means like your buddy, like your cousin, like your boy, your man, your main dude.
What about hyphy?
Oh, hyphy is an adjective that means wild, funky, good, like an up-tempo good. Sort of like crunk, but with a different intoxicant.
I just looked it up, Emily. Hyphy, the San Francisco slang for wild and good, is not in the dictionary. So we get that one.
Jesse? But Emily, you have thizz in there, right?
Fizz?
The verb to thizz?
Oh, I thought you meant physiognomy. It means face.
No. Thizz. T-H. Thizz.
T-H? T-H-I-Z-Z?
Yeah, fizz.
Let's just focus on...
I'm fizzing right now.
Let's just focus on hyphy. Emily, look.
How do you spell that?
H-Y-P-H-Y. Please make a case for hyphy. It means wild and good in the parlance of San Francisco, and when you put it in your dictionary, as I'm sure they will agree, just put in a picture of me and Jesse Thorne arm in arm next to the word. You don't even have to define it. Just put the picture in.
Okay.
Emily, what a pleasure to have you here with us again. Tell us again about your podcast, Word Matters. We can find it anywhere you find podcasts, and it's starting up now?
Yes, it's been live for a few weeks, and we've got new episodes that are released every Wednesday. And it's just conversations about language and about words and about misconceptions that people have. I think it's a lot of fun.
Thank you, Emily, so much for being here, as always. Emily Brewster, lexicographer editor at the Merriam-Webster Dictionary and a host of Word Matters podcast wherever you get podcasts.
Yeah, that's my cutty.
Thanks so much for having me.
The docket's clear. That's it for another episode of Judge John Hodgman. Our producer is Jennifer Marmer. Follow us on Twitter at Jesse Thorn. By the way, Jennifer liked it when I was thizzing. You couldn't hear her because her mic's off, but I could see in the thing that she liked it when I was thizzing. Our producer, Jennifer Marmer, follow us on Twitter at Jesse Thorn and at Hodgman. We're on Instagram at Judge John Hodgman. Make sure to hashtag your Judge John Hodgman tweets, hashtag JJHO, and check out the Maximum Fun subreddit. That's at MaximumFun.reddit.com to discuss this episode. Submit your cases at MaximumFun.org/JJHO or email Hodgman@MaximumFun.org. We'll talk to you next time on the Judge John Hodgman podcast.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.